sports fans live in the moment. There's only tonight. Game night. Welcome to Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet tonight, Brent Gunning, Josh Goldberg alongside me. We'll be here with you until the Leafs game is done. Leafs home against the Flames tonight. Well, at least some of the team. I don't know. It felt like every single time I opened my phone today, it was more Leafs lineup news. That's as good a place to start as any, of course. We will also have plenty of Raptors and Blue Jays thoughts for you as well. Got to bounce around the NHL as well. Sidney Crosby, he played a pretty important game this weekend. Lots to get into tonight. Text lines wide open, 590-590. Please include your name and location. We're talking a lot of Raptors tonight. What does this team do at the deadline? It's coming up. Kyle Lowry, he's questionable tomorrow, but we will start with a little bit of Leafs talk here. Josh, I mean, felt like every single time I looked at my phone, there was another Leafs player that was going to be missing tonight. Obviously, Freddie Anderson, just a couple of minutes ago, we found that out. That's the most recent piece of news, but the lineup looking a little depleted tonight.
Oof. That's an understatement, man. I don't know. I'm curious what you think about it. Hey, I understand when you're 14-3-2, you almost have to manufacture talking points because when it's all going great, you have less to talk about. So, you know, generally speaking, our job is to play armchair quarterback or armchair GM or armchair analyst, whatever it is, and find something compelling to talk about, whether it's positive or negative. And I see the lineup tonight, and I don't mind the idea of stacking the first line at all with Tavares up there with Matthews and Marner to get him going, I suppose. But for me, John Tavares's value, as much as anything, even if he's not necessarily finding the back of the net and the puck luck hasn't really been there for him, defensively, and you know, face-offs and just positionally, center is where I want to see him. I just feel like that's where he can be most impactful. And I have to say, I was quite surprised to see him up there and Nylander on the second line. Maybe you think it's more penance for Nylander's kind of dog of a game on Saturday night that saw him got benched a little bit. I definitely, especially since Willie plays left wing, it seemed like the natural move. He's playing left wing on the second line. I was definitely surprised that Sheldon Keefe went Tavares on that top line as opposed to Nylander.
Yeah, I'm surprised by it as well. It's not the move I would have done. I think the reason you throw Tavares up there, if I'm kind of, you know, trying to get inside Sheldon Keefe's brain, I think it's twofold. I think one, that Matthews Marner combination, but really that line, especially when Thornton's there, has looked so good this year that I think you really want to continue to ride that hot streak. And could you make the argument that those guys could do it with just about anybody on the left side? Yeah, you probably could, but I think when you factor that in along with the fact that, yeah, Tavares hasn't been going, this isn't what you want to see from him. Again, that's not the way I would set things up. I would have kept him on that second line, but you know who could probably do a really good Zach Hyman or Joe Thornton impression? The $11 million player we just talked about, John Tavares. It feels to me like this is a perfect scenario to say, okay, what's going to happen? We're going to stack you up against whatever we consider Calgary's top line. You're going to win that matchup, and then we still like our depth to kind of play even against Calgary. Again, not the way I would have done it, but it does seem like that's what's happening there. And you talk about us needing to manufacture talking points. Well, if we didn't have all these injuries today, Sheldon Keefe cooked up a lovely one for us on Saturday night with, you know, I know John Tortorella wouldn't want me to call it this, but with the benching of William Nylander, you know, you want to talk about chumming the waters of Toronto. Yeah. It feels like that there maybe is no more perfect topic than a Nylander benching to get the people going in one way or another. All the Neanderthals, as Stewie would call them.
Well, it is what it is, I think, to an extent with him. He leaves a lot to be desired. You know, there was a clip making the rounds on Twitter the other night of him just He's a flyby type of guy, right? Sometimes he wins a battle, or you know, he has an active stick defensively, and he can take a puck away and transport it back up the ice. He does that more than never. It hasn't maybe been as often this year as it certainly was last year at other points in his career, but too many times this year it's just been lackadaisical, you know, flybys, not really putting that effort to put some pressure on somebody in the defensive zone, and we saw that on Montreal, and that probably contributed to the benching there in the third period. But he is what he is, I think, at this point. He's, I want to say, 24 years old. I wouldn't go as far as to call him a finished product completely as a National Hockey League player, but he's definitely closer to a finished product than anything else. I don't think that he's all of a sudden going to look like a different player. He may have more success just offensively because he's got a lot of gifts and he's got a lot of tools in the toolbox offensively, and he could, in the right situation, you know, threaten, I think, 40 goals and be a point per game type of player. But I don't think it's going to look a lot different than it's looked up until this point of his handful of years in the National Hockey League. And I think for the most part, he's a polarizing lightning rod player. We've had this conversation so many times. So many people have one thought about him that, yeah, he can put up points and be great at times, but there are too many shifts, there are too many periods, there are too many games where he floats in and out, and he's just not as enough of a factor to be the type of player that you want to build around or to be a big part of your core Stanley Cup type of team. And I've always fallen into the I see more in him category, but at the same time, I can see why tons of people have issues with him. I would never go about saying, yeah, you're dead wrong about William Nylander and sometimes his lack of effort or, you know, some of his complacency issues. I acknowledge them, but I still think the good outweighs the bad when it comes to him. And I would just, I said this yesterday about Morgan Riley during the show, and to an extent with William Nylander, I feel the same way. If you trade a William Nylander, what are you getting? And what are the odds that that type of presence in your lineup is missed? Because you don't have anyone else behind William Nylander who can come up into his place in the lineup and realistically replicate or come anywhere near what he's capable of doing.
No, that's true. I think you lose a Nylander trade almost always. The thing I'd say about, I agree with most of what you said there in terms of he kind of is what he is. I do think that's true. The one kind of caveat I would give to that, and I think time is starting to run out for this, is that I firmly believe a deep playoff run can kind of change a player. And this isn't to say he is going to be the everything and the effort and the puck battles and the pugnacity, not to say that it's going to make him that type of player. But I just, you know, and again, I don't want to, because these guys were compared a lot earlier on in their career, obviously not so much now. You know, I look at a player like David Pastrnak, and would he play the way he plays if he wasn't constantly in the fire of deep playoff runs every single time he, from the jump that he was in this league? And, you know, that's not to, you know, take any blame away from Willie. He definitely deserves it some of the time. But I think that's maybe one thing that could change kind of what you get out of him as a player. Obviously, you know, the lines looking very different tonight. If you missed it, it is John Tavares, Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner on the first line, Nylander, Kerfoot, Barabanov, Mikheyev, Engvall, VC, and then Patan, Boyd, and Spezza on the fourth line. I'd imagine everything outside of that top line is going to be jumbled like crazy tonight. You're going to see Spezza getting some chances with more offensive guys, you know, not that the Patan isn't as well, but it feels to me like tonight, Goldberg, it's just going to be a jumble in that bottom nine, if you want to call it that.
This seems like, I don't want to be hyperbolic. You know me, I'm not generally one for being hyperbolic, but I look at Barabanov going from mothballs for a while now. I honestly, I can't remember the last time Barabanov drew into the lineup, to go from that press box, you know, chomping popcorn in the press box to second line minutes. And you're right, 100%. The lines will not look the same. Potentially, in a couple minutes. It could just all be in pencil and then just all over the place for Sheldon Keefe. But Barabanov getting top 6 minutes tonight in a primo spot with Nylander and Kerfoot, is this a last opportunity of sorts for him? Injuries are always going to play a factor, and I think he's out as is. When this team's fully healthy, he's not likely to play. But I just wonder if they want to give him one last push here with legitimate opportunity to see if maybe there's something more than meets the eye. Because so far, he hasn't been terrible. He just hasn't been good either. He's a lot like Jimmy Vesey. They're on the ice. They're on the lineup card. But if you ask me to name a play of significance one way or the other for them in a given night, I probably would have to rewind and rewatch the game a couple of times to get there. So I just wonder if this maybe is a last gasp of sorts to see if Barabanov is anything more than a break glass in case of emergency type of player.
And speaking of breaking glass, Jimmy Vesey making his way to the locker room, it looks like. So, hey, who knows? The banged up Leafs maybe even more banged up as it is. I agree with you completely there. It does feel like, okay, I know this isn't a real top six because, you know, Alex Kerfoot is not the guy you think of as your center in the top six. But it does feel like, okay, here's your top 6 minutes. Do something with them, please. Because, you know, I agree with you. He hasn't been bad, but he's been a complete non-entity. And with the skill that is kind of up and down this lineup, when you're getting looks to play with Spezza, we've seen how kind of dangerous he can be. So it does kind of feel like it's I don't want to say do or die, but make something with it opportunity right now. And I think another thing Keefe is going to play around with a little bit, maybe tonight, maybe it kind of lasts throughout this stretch here, is just seeing what kind of clicks among all of these guys. Because you know you might have your favorites. Maybe you're a Pierre Engvall truther. Maybe you did like VC, whatever it is. There's really not a lot to separate a lot of these guys in the kind of true bottom six once it gets there. So I think it's a lot about just kind of seeing what pairs work, because when there's such little difference between these guys, just having the right chemistry with the right center kind of can help separate these guys. Because outside of Spezza and Boyd, I don't know that, you know, and obviously, you know, Mikheyev is going to kind of find himself there. I don't know that anybody's really kind of jumped out. Engvall has moments, but because you think there's a little more there, he can frustrate you too. It does feel like there is a real jumble in that bottom six.
Yeah, I still think that there's a lot of uncertainty. Like, I don't think that bottom six is by any means close to a finished product. I don't know how many of those guys you would really feel confident slotting in, you know, come playoff time outside of Spezza. I have to say Boyd has intrigued me. He has certainly a lot of impressive moments. You know, he probably still leaves something to be desired, but as far as a fourth liner, I feel like you could do a whole heck of a lot worse than him. Patan, I think we've seen enough from Nick Patan to know that he's not somebody that you can rely on with any sort of consistency. Loses too many puck battles. I wonder when we're getting a Galchenyuk sighting, because I'm not high on Galchenyuk. I don't think he's going to come in here and light the world on fire and revolutionize the bottom six and be just this revelation. But I think he could at least in theory offer something. But I'm not blind to the fact that he could just be terrible and come in and, you know, maybe you give him 3 to 5 games or something like that and he's useless defensively and he doesn't generate anything offensively, as we've seen from him as he's bounced around, you know, 7 teams now in 7 years. But at least I feel like I'd like to see what he can bring, because a lot of the guys in that bottom six, I feel like we've seen enough from them this year to know what they're going to bring for the most part into the lineup. So you're not going to be that much worse off without them. You can always go back because you know what their contributions, generally speaking, are. Whereas I feel like Galchenyuk, you probably have an idea what it's going to be, but at least there's a little bit of intrigue to what he could possibly bring in this type of situation, in this type of system, with this type of team.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you right now, I would rather have Alex Galchenyuk in the top six tonight than Barabanov.
Yes.
Like, maybe that's crazy because he hasn't played in however long, but neither is Barabanov. Like you said, he's been on mothballs. A couple more things about this team before we switch gears. Aaron Rowe is going to join us. Former colleague of ours going to come on. It was Sports Illustrated Now going to talk to us about the Raptors. Of course, big win for them yesterday. But, you know, maybe the most important injury that this team has kind of dealt with at any point this season is the one they're dealing with right now. No Jake Muzzin. Anytime I hear broken face, that just sounds super uncomfortable, but I think this is going to be a massive stretch for kind of the entire D-Core, but specifically, of course, Dermott and Hall.
Yes, Dermott in particular, I'm really interested to see what he can do with more minutes. How many Leafs fans have been, oh, and Hutch just lets in an absolute dog of a goal.
We'll get to him.
How many times have we heard, oh, well, Travis Dermott, you know, let's see what he could do with 22 minutes a night and playing in big situations. And we saw it a little bit last year when Riley and or Muzzin were hurt. And Dermott, I thought, had some good moments. And I wonder if he is a legitimate top four option going forward. I see a lot of the virtue that he brings to the table. Great skater, can transport the puck up the ice. He can move it crisply in terms of a pass, but it's a lot different when you're going up against the creme de la creme in the National Hockey League a lot. It's one thing on the third pair if you get the odd shift, you moonlight, and you see a couple of shifts there. But when you're seeing top end competition shift after shift, I wonder if he can handle it. And that is a real hot button pairing because Hall has been great, and I don't want to take anything away from Justin Hall. He's arguably been the Leafs' most complete defenseman this year. But how much of that do you factor into just the veteran presence, the steady hand of Jake Muzzin? And Travis Dermott's not a hair on fire type of defenseman, but he's not the calming presence, I would say, that a Jake Muzzin is. He takes more chances, right? He likes to activate into the play. And I just wonder what kind of adjustment we're going to see from Hall. If this is a prolonged absence, you know, maybe five games or something like that, I wonder if we'll see any slip in Hall's game without Muzzin.
Well, that's the thing, right? Because I think most people actually really like what you've seen from both guys, Hall and Dermott this year. But I think most people are saying, well, I think a lot of that has to do with the influence of their partner. I think, you know, Travis Dermott's looked better beside Bogosian than he's looked at any point in his NHL career. And some of that's him taking leaps, but some of that's also having a competent partner beside him. And then, you know, same goes for Hall and Muzzin there. So I think it is going to be interesting. I do think they can work pretty well stylistically, because you know Hall can kind of be that more stay-at-home guy, but they're both kind of somewhat new age D. They're willing to get in the rush, they're willing to make that first pass, able to do so. Yeah, I think that's going to be really interesting here, and I think this is a time to kind of find out exactly what you have in Dermott. It sounds like, you know, I was reading some of the quotes today that, you know, it sounds like Muzzin will have a face shield on when he returns. If that's going to be the case, it doesn't sound like it should be too long. So it feels like just the right amount of runway to figure out what you've got here without needing to panic if it doesn't look exactly, you know, the way you want it to. The one bummer I have about all this is that Rasmus Sandin is banged up, because, you know, we've been opining, begging for him to get in the lineup. They sent him down to the Marlies, and then he, I believe, breaks his foot or has a foot injury at the very least. It really seems like a tough break for him that he's not able to get in the mix, because you know he'd be working his way into some games now.
Huge. Yeah, definitely. I thought about that a little bit today, and it's definitely a real disappointment, because I feel like he's ready for the NHL. I know it was a smallish sample size last year, not a ton of minutes, but I didn't think he was overwhelmed by any means. There were some rougher moments, but I thought he looked pretty well and he held up pretty well. But I guess the Lehtinen factor cushions it a bit for me, because I'm still intrigued by what Mikko Lehtinen could bring to the table. It hasn't really gone, I think, the way a lot of people expected. It's still such a small amount of games that I don't think we can really make a declaration on it. But he still does things out there and looks out there. You know, he's a strong skater. He can, we saw him already tonight kind of pirouette at the blue line and fire a puck on net. He's got good sense. He's got a good skill set, I think. It's just, it's a lot to ask any player, let alone a defenseman, to transfer from a different league with a different ice surface, all sorts of different intricacies. And I still think Mikko Lehtinen could be a factor at some point this year, but at full strength, it's hard to see him cracking into the top six as this blue line is currently constructed. And it says, I think it says less about him and more about how pleasantly surprising and strong this Maple Leafs blue line appears to be when it's at fully healthy strength.
If Muzzin was healthy tonight, would you have considered going 11-7? I hate 11-7 always,
yes.
But with this banged up a group, and again, it's a non-issue because Muzzin's hurt, but if he was healthy, what would you have done?
I probably wouldn't have done it because I'm with you. I loathe 11-7, yeah. And I feel like a lot of the Leafs' crappiest performances this year have been, I don't know if it's coincidentally or not, 11-7 alignments, so I see it in a banged up situation, you know, just wanting to have that configuration in this type of circumstance, especially without one of your big minute munchers on the back end out there. But I honestly, unless it's a real dire straits, and even then, I feel like 11-7 just seems to throw everything out of whack.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. All right. We didn't talk about Michael Hutchison, but quite honestly, that's probably for the best. There will be plenty more at Leafs talk as well. Of course, once the game's over, Gord Stellick, Nick Alberga will be here for Leafs Nation postgame. But before the game's even over, those guys will jump on with us in the first and second intermissions, respectively. Of course, going to talk a little Raptors as well. Big, big win. Can they do it again when they're back against Philly once again? Of course, Kyle Lowry is questionable. We'll see what happens there. And hey, is how the Raptors are looking without Kyle Lowry making you change your minds about what the future holds for this franchise? It better not. You better have the faith. That's Josh Goldberg. I'm Brent Gunning. We'll talk a little more Raptors next on Sportsnet tonight. Sportsnet tonight, Brent Cunning and Josh Goldberg alongside me. We'll be here with you until the Leafs and Flames are done down at Scotiabank Arena. So far, not so good for the Leafs. We'll tell you more about that when Gord Stellick or Nick Alberga joins us in the first intermission. But joining us right now, our buddy, Raptors reporter, Sports Illustrated, Aaron Rose. Aaron, how's it going, bud?
I'm doing well. Excited to be back on with you guys.
Fired up to have you, bud. So let's start. Big win yesterday against 76ers. You know, Joel Embiid, he certainly got his, if you just look at the stat sheet, but it felt like the Raptors really caused him to kind of pass out of the post a ton. It felt like they were blitzing him a lot, at least from my eyes. What did you make of how they held Embiid in the first of two straight against him?
Well, they certainly, as you mentioned, they put a lot of pressure on him, and that's sort of the trademark of the Raptors. Anytime they go up against a superstar like they did Giannis the other night or Joel Embiid last night, they're going to send as much attention as they possibly can. And I was listening into the press conference with Joel Embiid from yesterday, and he was saying that was basically the most pressure, the most attention he's seen from a defense all season. So the Raptors were throwing bodies at him. I think Aaron Baines did a really impressive job on him, something Raptors fans probably haven't heard a lot of this year, but he did a really good job. And then everyone else, you had Fred VanVleet collapsing in and getting his pesky hands in the way, and guys all over were really collapsing into the paint to stop Joel Embiid and then getting back out whenever he made those kick out passes, which, as you mentioned, he did a lot of last night.
So I feel like OG and Anobi, we know he's a vital cog to what this team does, but I see a game like last night, and you know what he brings defensively when he's on the court. This team, you know, I think has championship level defense, like top five, top three in the league defense. Like, where do you think he is right now in the pecking order of most impactful defensive players in the NBA?
Well, it's weird because this Raptors defense is so good. I think everyone is a little bit undervalued, but you could easily have two guys on this team who are all defense players in OG Anunoby and Fred VanVleet. Those two guys are basically two of the best guys at their position. But I think when you're talking about a wing stopper, somebody who can go out and defend sort of anyone on the court, and I think that's what's so impressive about OG Anunoby, is he can go up with the exception of like the truly really, really big guys like Joel Embiid. But even if Giannis Antetokounmpo, he can go up and he can defend Giannis Antetokounmpo, and then he can go down a few spots and defend defend some of the shooting guards and even some of the bigger point guards in the NBA. So he's got to be one of the best isolation defenders and one of the best one-on-one and versatile defenders in the NBA. And I think, as you mentioned, he's one of the guys that is a real difference maker for the Raptors. If you're a team that has championship aspirations, you need to have a guy like that who you can just say, you know what, I need you to stop whoever tonight, Giannis Antetokounmpo. And he says, yes, sir, I'll go do it. And then he just does it.
Well, and it feels like it's so much more important on a team like this that kind of has the lack of bigs depth that they do, right? Like, you know, in years past or kind of generations past, you'd say, okay, let everybody through and, you know, Dwight Howard or whoever will kind of clean it up. But it feels like it just kind of allows you to kind of shy away from some of the deficiencies you do have there. If we're going to talk about, you know, defense, I feel like Fred VanVleet gets a ton of credit for what he does on the offensive end of the floor. But, you know, it's funny how similar yet different him and Kyle Lowry are. Like, you know, Fred VanVleet, a defensive beast, but he doesn't do it taking charges. He does it picking pockets or blocking shots for that matter. Like, it is funny just how many ways these guys are similar, but just slightly different.
Yeah, he's got some of the craziest hands. He's like a boxer. He's got the quickest hands in the NBA, maybe. He's constantly jumping in, as we talked about before, into the paint. And we saw him the other night against Giannis, where he just grabbed the ball as Giannis was going up for a layup. And I was looking at some of the stat sheets, and he doesn't, they don't record those as steals, which I find so strange. They're recorded as blocks. So you'll see guys go up with the ball, and he'll just grab it, and they say it's an attempt, a shot attempt. And he's, I guess, blocking the ball, from blocking the shot. And he was saying that if those were recorded as steals, he'd be, like, leading the league in steals. But you're right. He's got such great hands, and he's always near the top of the league in deflections. And this year he's getting his hands on even more balls and certainly picking up passes and getting steals more so than ever before.
So you and I have talked a number of times over the season about Pascal Siakam and, you know, what the trajectory of his year has been like, all over the place, kind of a bit of a roller coaster. But I feel like, you know, certainly in the month of February, he has been excellent across the board. There haven't been that many off nights or clunkers. It's been pretty, you know, aggressive and resembling the player we saw certainly pre-bubble last year. So I ask you, is it safe to say Pascal Siakam is back, or do we still need to see more?
Well, I remember this conversation we had, and you were saying he's back, and I said, you know, I'm not ready to say that yet, but I think I've come around, and I think I'm with you on this, that he's looking like that guy he was last season. And I think Nick Nurse talks about this all the time, that what he's looking for from sort of that star-level player is consistency. So sort of anyone can go off and score 20, 30 points a night, but is what do you do on your off nights? Are you sort of contributing 5 points? Or when you're having an off shooting night, are you still getting to the line? Are you still making an impact by passing the ball, by collecting assists on the defensive end? And I think we're seeing that recently with Pascal Siakam, that even when his shot isn't falling, which it has been lately, he's still able to impact the game either by defense or his assist numbers are up this season. So he's really coming together as a more complete player the way we saw last year. And it's really exciting because he's sort of back to the way he was.
Yeah, it is kind of crazy how different the perception would be if I'm trying to remember what game it was where he had the bunny just kind of die on the rim there. If he gets even one or two of those late game looks that he's had the opportunity to fall, it does feel like it would kind of allowed people to get to this point a little bit sooner with him. You know, the Raptors have got a little stretch here without Kyle Lowry. They may not have him tomorrow. What, if anything, do you think this kind of tells us about what the kind of post-Lowry future of this team looks like?
Well, if you look at the raw numbers, they're like something like 18-0 without Kyle Lowry over the last 18 games, I guess, that he hasn't started or at least hasn't finished, because there's a few games in there that he left early because of injury. So if you want to look at that, you can say maybe they're way better without Kyle Lowry, and maybe they're, you know, going to have a very bright future. I'm not willing to say that. The truth is I haven't come up with a great reason why they're playing so well without Kyle Lowry. Maybe it's just a sample size thing because it's very, very strange. But I think when you look at this team, if Norman Powell continues to play as well as he's playing over the past stretch, maybe he's a guy who's, you know, not just going to opt out next season, but maybe he re-signs and he's a guy the Raptors actually want back long term. And then you've got a pretty nice group with Fred VanVleet, Norman Powell, Pascal Siakam, and OG Anunoby. Maybe Chris Boucher is contributing down the road the way he has recently. He's been really exciting. And, you know, that's a group of five guys under 20, or sorry, under 30, excuse me, who can really, you know, contribute for the years to come. You throw in Malachi Flynn and he takes a step forward. So I think Raptors fans should be excited about a Kyle Lowry-less future, we'll say 10 years down the line when he eventually retires.
Yeah, please, no time soon.
So I'm kind of curious. I feel like I don't think it's an either-or situation. It could be both are not part of this mix as soon as next season. But like, where are you on a Norm Powell future in terms of a deal beyond this year, which seems to be going up? You know, the price of the brick seems to be going up with each passing day on Norm Powell. And maybe you look to dangle him if somebody really sees him as a big piece to contending this year. Like, what do you think the future holds for the Raptors and Norm Powell?
Well, I think if you had asked me a week ago before this stretch where they've beaten some really impressive teams, I might have said, you know, if they don't play well against the Bucks and if they lose a pair of games against the Sixers, maybe they start to look that way and try and sell off assets. But right now they're playing really well, and I can't see a reason why they should sell off assets other than trying to recoup something. But this is a team that if they're playing the way they're playing now, well, they just beat the Bucks, and they looked really good. They beat the 76ers. Maybe they'll beat them again tomorrow night. So I would say play out the rest of the season, and if Norman Powell opts out, which right now it looks like he will, then the Raptors can make a bid at him. This we talked in the offseason about how this upcoming offseason, next offseason, is going to be loaded with talent. You have Giannis Antetokounmpo and all these big-name guys, and all those guys basically re-signed. Norman Powell might be in store for a big payday because all these teams have money, the Raptors included, and nobody to spend it on. So Norm would be wise to opt out. And if the Raptors can come to terms with him on a reasonable deal, he's still a guy that can generate offense. And at times that's been something the Raptors have lacked. He's not a guy who's afraid to shoot, and he can attack sort of the rim at a really high level. He's super efficient when he's playing well, which he has been lately. So it's a guy that I think the Raptors should be interested in locking up long-term when the season comes to an end and when he probably opt out.
I agree with everything you said there, except for the fact that, are we all the way there with Norm Powell? I think that this stretch you've seen this month, him as a starter, basically since OG got hurt against the Pacers, it's been incredible. But it just feels like, you know, he might have played himself into Fred VanVleet money, especially when you factor in all of the people that are kind of no longer available. You know, are you at any point worried about, and again, I realize this isn't a decision they're having to make now, but are you at all worried about the price of Powell just being kind of way too high when it does come time to make that decision? Because I'm very torn on it. I love what I've seen as a player. We've also seen, albeit not quite like this for quite this long, but we've seen these stretches before from him as well.
Yeah, he's always been inconsistent, although he's never really done. He had that stretch right before the pandemic where he was playing unbelievably and he won player of the week. But he's never done what he's done now, and I'm sure at some point he's going to look like that really bad Powell who's sort of unplayable the way he was at the beginning of the season. I think if one of these, you know, bad teams that has all this money comes over and says, we're going to pay him Fred VanVleet money, though he's not Fred VanVleet and he's not at Fred VanVleet's age, so I agree with you in that sense. But if he goes through another lull this season and, you know, maybe people aren't as excited about him, I think there's still a lot of offensive firepower that the Raptors need. And I guess I'll say to you, you know, what are the Raptors going to spend their money on? It's nice to have that flexibility.
But someone tall, maybe.
Well, someone tall, although I'm not sure who that guy is out there. They're probably not going to go out and sign an Andre Drummond or someone like that. So Norman Powell provides some offensive punch, and he's a guy that, for the right number, which is an easy pass by me just to say, but the Raptors front office makes good decisions, and I think people trust them, and they'll come to a right number, and Norman Powell will either accept it or walk this offseason.
Do you think that the abrupt departure of Chris Finch, where he gave, I think he gave a halftime interview last night or certainly Friday night against Minnesota, and now he's gone. And kudos to him. He got a gig, multi-year deal in Minnesota, even though it's not great there. But kudos to him for getting it. Do you think there'll be any discernible impact, at least maybe in the short term, on the Raptors? Or do you think that their principles are so firm that it shouldn't be much of an issue no longer having him on the bench?
Well, it's weird to sort of dole out credit to a guy like him because I'm not there every day. I can't see what's going on. And how am I supposed to know the difference between why are Pascal Siakam's assist numbers up? Are they up because he's progressed as a player? Or are they up because, well, at the beginning of the year, Chris Finch came in and said he wanted to make Pascal Siakam a better playmaker, and that meant making him a better passer. So I think that Chris Finch had some tangible impact on this team. Their offense is better. Their half-court offense is better. They lost two really good dynamic offensive players in Marc Gasol and Serge Ibaka, replaced them with Aron Baynes, who I think we can call not the most offensively dynamic player, and their offense is better. So I think Chris Finch deserves some credit for that. How much? I can't really tell you without being there every day, but he deserves something. I'm not sure how much it'll make a step back for the Raptors necessarily, because I think that he had an impact. Nick Nurse said he learned a lot from working with Chris Finch, and I think those ideals will carry over. Nick Nurse is going to take over the offensive responsibilities for the rest of the season, or at least for the next little while. And then they'll bring in somebody, and I think we can trust Nick Nurse at this point to make good hires, because he's done it in the past. Now we're seeing all these guys from his coaching staff are going on and becoming head coaches around the league.
Yeah, Nick Nurse, the new Andy Reid with this coaching tree he's developing there down in Tampa now. Aaron, always love having you on. Thanks for taking the time, bud.
Happy to do it.
There he goes, Aaron Ben Rose, Raptors reporting. Follow him on Twitter at Aaron Ben Rose, Raptors reporter, Sports Illustrated. So, Goldberg, I think that's kind of the big question with the Raptors right now is the Powell thing. I think we all have to be, you know, wherever you were to start this run from him, you're definitely more of a believer now. But I'll admit, you know, I still have my, and again, it's a good problem to have in that the Raptors don't have to make this decision right now. But I, you know, short of seeing this, the entire rest of the season, and boy, if Powell's going to look like this, this team certainly will be going on a bit of a run. I still kind of have my qualms with giving him a big deal that I'm almost positive he's playing himself into this offseason.
Yeah, I think I'm probably in the same line of thinking, and to me, it's honestly less about Powell, because I think he is a solid player and would help a bunch of teams. But if you're telling me Norm Powell's, like, let's say it's 4 years, I don't know, in that 70 to 75 million range, not quite 20 million, but approaching 20 million. It's not a hugely burdensome contract. I think it could be a movable contract at some point, but then you're really locking into a core for the most part of Fred, Pascal, OG, Norm. And I don't think that that's a bad core by any means. I think that that's, depending on what else is around, if you continue drafting, developing the way that the Raptors have, that can be the makings of a 50-win team and somebody who puts pressure on plenty of teams in the Eastern Conference. But the ceiling, I don't think, is all that high on that team. You could try and convince me that both Pascal, Fred, and I guess to an extent also OG and Norm will continue to get better, and maybe things will look a little bit different. But I don't know if they'll all get better enough, steadily improve to the point that the ceiling, the you know, future of this team is anything more than what we think it is really right now. Like, do we see that as a championship level core? I'm probably inclined to say no right now, and I don't know if my answer is going to change that much in the next year or two.
The only way that's a championship core is if OG Anunoby, and again, I don't want to be critical of this player. I love this player. You want to talk about a lunch pail guy. We just talked about him with Aaron. He can defend anybody. He needs to take a leap and a bound offensively and consistently in that regard, and I just don't know that that's going to happen. Again, you know, not everyone has to be an all-NBA player, but that's what would kind of have to happen for that core to be looking at a championship for me. But, you know, obviously, still a lot of time left in OG and Anunoby's development. Not a lot of time left in the first period of the Leafs game. They're down at Scotiabank Arena right now, playing host to Calgary right now. We will continue Sportsnet tonight here. Gord Stellick, you'll be hearing him after the game is done with Leafs Nation postgame. He and Nick Alberga. Gord's going to join us next. Tell us what we've missed in a very interesting day in Leafs Nation. That's Josh Goldberg. I'm Brent Gunning, and this is Sportsnet tonight. Sportsnet tonight, Brent Gunning, Josh Goldberg will be here with you until the Leafs and Flames are done down at Scotiabank Arena. They are done. 1 period. 1-0 for the bad guys. Leafs trail after one. It is Sam Bennett, funnily enough, getting the goal. Trade rumors seem to have swirled a little less around him. Joining us now, not to talk about the Flames, but to talk about the Leafs. Co-host, Leafs Nation pre- and post-game tonight, Gord Stellick. How you doing, Gord?
Gentlemen, I'm doing well.
So let's just jump right into loading up the top line. Boy, I'm getting flashbacks to Game 5 against Columbus. I seem to remember this from before. Are you surprised at all that Keefe decided to load it up tonight? And do you expect that line will kind of stay together throughout the course of the game?
Not totally, because with Joe Thornton being out, right, you had to make a move anyway. We'll see. I think the point is to try it for – if you're going to do something, try all these different options and, you know, try them for the whole game. He wasn't doing this like the second half, like he did, as you mentioned, again, in those games against Columbus. So you've got seemingly this excess of offensive, you know, positive cards you can play. The big worry is the guy in net right now. I mean, that's what we've always talked about, depth and goal.
Boy, have
and
we.
Once again, it briefly rears its ugly head.
Yeah, I actually thought Hutch, you know, it was a credit to him that he rebounded the way that he did. But, yeah, it's still not a goal that you want to see go in. I'm curious, you know, with Jake Muzzin out, we're seeing Dermott and Hall play together. And Justin Hall deserves all of the praise he's received this year. He's been excellent. But how much of an adjustment do you think it's going to be for a player like Hall, who's become so accustomed to having that steadying presence of Jake Muzzin across the ice from him, adjusting? I know he's had minutes in the past with Travis Dermott, but adjusting to the way that Travis Dermott plays.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, it's funny. I don't know what happened that Montreal game or whatever. There just were a lot of injuries all of a sudden when you went to work for puck drop tonight. But you see generally with the Leafs that you have Morgan Rielly gets the most minutes. The other four, there's a relative sameness. And then Travis Dermott gets the least minutes. It's not a ridiculously low number, but that's, you know, kind of the way it's happened. So, obviously, in that case, if you're Justin Hall, you're playing with a guy that, well, when I say less experienced, but hasn't played as well as your regular partner. Can he? Well, that's what we're going to find out. You know, this is what didn't happen last year, which almost seemed to more happen for Travis Dermott 2 years ago, that he seemed to initially seize the opportunity more than last year, where really not a lot of players did. So I would think probably if you're Justin Hall, whatever little habits, whatever that, you know, there's a yin and yang that you can do with comfort and, you know, your previous partner will cover you up. You have to do with a little bit more trepidation right now, at least initially.
I just worry now, you know, you just have two big offensive powerhouses back there in Dermott and Hall, you know, both scoring goals these days. You got to pull the reins a little bit. Kidding, people. You know, somebody who had the reins pulled on Saturday night, William Nylander. He got benched. Sheldon Keefe didn't shy away from it, didn't seem to want to make too big a point of it either. What have you made of his game tonight? Obviously, he's not with his normal center in John Tavares.
Yeah, you know, Brad, and you got, well, a night that Jeff Skinner is being benched in Buffalo. Like, wow. I you know, there was one play they pointed out there that the thinking was, you know, that Nylander probably had a chance from the side of the net to, there was room there to go, but he chose to go behind the net and kind of set it up that way. And I don't want to say that's a lack of confidence or something like that. I don't really know that, but, you know, there tends to be that kind of hesitancy a little bit. So, I thought his play's been okay. I thought after that stinker of a first goal against them, they started getting some chances a little bit later on. We thought Morgan Rielly had scored. Jason Spezza had a great chance later on. The Calgary goaltender has been really sharp. Reminds me a lot of how Freddie played in the first period against Montreal to keep the Leafs in that game. So, more and more we'll see over the next 40 minutes about the offensive getting going. But, you know, he didn't stand out positively or didn't stand out negatively.
Do you think that a player like Sam Bennett, there's been so many discussions about what his future is in Calgary, pending UFA, grew up a Leafs fan from the GTA, is that the type of player that you think could make a lot of sense if the Leafs do want to add a forward in the lead up to the deadline? Or do you think they should look more in that sense of somebody who can fit more comfortably into the top six?
Yeah, you know, Josh, I mean, part is you think also teams are going to be a little bit hesitant if Calgary's going to be in the playoffs playing the Leafs, like, to, you know, yeah. Traditionally trade deadline deals are for a draft pick, right? You know, so you're not going to give up a potentially core nine forward who may play against you in the playoffs for, I don't know, say a third round pick. I don't know what Sam Bennett would go for as a UFA. So, in the Leafs case, if you were to get him for that, yeah, I think that would be a good depth piece that way. I mean, you're still – you get injuries. You're still hoping to get those third, fourth lines going. Some nights you really see some depth from those lines. Just as you know, you kick the show off. Remember against Columbus, there was barely two lines going. And a lot of last season, again, that was a constant theme from Sheldon Keefe. We need more from our third and fourth line. So I wouldn't be against something like that. And again, because he is a pending unrestricted free agent, those are the guys that don't go for, you know, you don't have to give a big ticket in return.
You mentioned Hutchison there at the beginning. He is in net tonight. Obviously, Jack Campbell not quite ready. Joseph Wall backing him up. How do you feel like the team has looked in front of him? Because at least in my eyes last year, when it was Hutch in net, it just felt like this team played with a complete kind of lack of confidence, trepidation. They almost played scared, and then that led to more chances coming back Hutch's way, which is not what you want. How do you feel like the team has looked in front of him in the time we've seen that this year, the two times now, I guess?
Yeah, you're spot on. The guy had no luck last year, and the guy, you're right. I mean, it wasn't the team. He was going there. The team had a few times last year where they didn't play very well. They had that was the problem last year, some real roles like that, and he was involved in one of them. I thought they looked better. I did. I thought they looked better after that. And, you know, if it ends up being the one clunker and you get back in the game, you know, good on him, good on the team. That way, it's just so early, and just that script, and you thought the last game when he got the win, okay, we can move on for that. That's, you know, this is why they got Jack Campbell. That's why they kept Aaron Dale as a third goaltender for as long as they could, you know, mm-hmm. that way, depth-wise. So, to your point, I do like the team's in a way better place this year than they were last year when, you know, the team in front of him struggled as he struggled.
So, Austin Matthews is deservingly getting Hart Trophy conversation, and he's just been as good as any player, maybe better than any player in the league so far through about 20 games. But I feel like we're not really talking quite as much about Mitch Marner. And I guess is it a chicken and egg situation where you have to give a fair bit of the credit to Matthews as a result of playing with Marner and Marner credit as a result of playing with Matthews?
Yeah, I'm kind of looking, it's funny, the Patrick King, Jonathan Toews scenario, maybe a little bit that way. And, you know, ultimately, at the end of the days, if these guys could get three Stanley Cup rings, I'm sure they'd be ecstatic with one Stanley Cup ring. But, you know, early on, it seemed, Josh, that, you know, Mitch Marner almost was the bigger pleasant surprise early on, you know, the first year or two, because Austin was the number one overall pick and, you know, came with all this hype. It's just that this year, his goal scoring, and it's just so visual to see what Brett Hull did decades ago, to see what Ovi's done the last couple of years, and to see him bring it to that particular level. And, you know, goals are just hard to find. It's hard to score goals. And he's out there doing it, and that's not taking a single thing away from Mitch Marner. I look at when they were all rookies, and this is why you're looking forward to great things. I believe the Toronto Maple Leafs are the only team that had three different players win the Rookie of the Month award the same year. Nylander won it once, and Marner and Matthews also won it. I mean, there's only 7 months in the regular season to give that Rookie of the Month award out. I mean, that just showed the kind of riches they had, whatever it was 4 years ago.
Yeah, very, very, very well said. And that's kind of the whole promise of this team, right? Is that all of them will get going at the same time, and they're able to kind of pull on the rope together. Gord, thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed the chat. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, guys.
There he goes, Gord Stellick. You'll hear him after the game as well. We'll talk to his buddy, Nick Alberga, in the second intermission. Leafs trailing Calgary at the end of the first period down at Scotiabank Arena, 1-0. Sam Bennett with the goal. Obviously, there's always going to be a lot of consternation, wondering what's happening in Leafs land. But it's kind of funny to think of the way the pulse has been around this team, and their record is, 11-3-2, or even better than that now, actually. But it's just amazing to see how high the temperature's kind of been this year, despite how much success the group has had.
That's just the way. It's just the way.
It's the way it is.
Right?
Hey.
Well, I was having this conversation with a buddy of mine, and we basically agreed that if the Leafs continue to run roughshod on this division, it's you're playing in this junk JV division. Who really cares? Talk to me mm-hmm. in the playoffs. But every time they lose, it's ooh, that's a bad loss. There's no excuse for a loss like that in this kind of division. So it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation here for the Maple Leafs. I think I was saying this yesterday, and I've been saying this for a little while now, after they kind of settled into the season after a rocky first weekend, first couple of games. This is the least concerned with the Maple Leafs I've been in years, and as long as I can remember. If we're talking about what they're going to get from their bottom six as the big problem for their team, I think that's probably a pretty good problem to have. And their bottom six hasn't been a zero by any means. It just, you know, it's a bottom six. For the most part, for a lot of teams, it's going to be up and down. So if that continues to be the big bugaboo, and I still think they could make a move that could really shuffle the deck chairs and make things look a lot better, we're on easy street here, covering the team, talking about the team, being fans of the team. It's a good spot to be.
Well, and the other thing I thought was interesting there, you mentioned the kind of, you know, is Marner getting enough love? I know in terms of kind of where I come from at it, I remember that first John Tavares season, and every single intermission was, oh, look at the Marner point. They're pointing to Mitch. It feels like he got enough cookies in the first few years of him being a Leaf, that I think him, if he is getting a little bit, you know, shorted on credit right now, I think that's just fine. And again, goals worth more than assists. And the last thing I'll kind of put a bow on that is Mitch Marner's a superstar, a special player. Austin Matthews is generational, and there are different. There are different levels to this, and just because, you know, one guy's a little bit higher doesn't mean the other guy is getting slighted. That's Josh Goldberg. I'm Brent Gutting. More Leafs talk coming up during the second intermission. Once the game is over, Nick Alberga, Gord Stellick will have you covered with Leaf Nation postgame. But of course, you're going to be hearing plenty of Blue Jays on this station as well once the regular season starts up. We know spring training is in full swing. We heard from some of the guys today, including Bo Bichette. He had some interesting comments. We'll hear some of those. We'll set up our batting order. How's the rotation look? Who's the X factor? Lots of Blue Jays to kick around. We'll do that next on Sportsnet tonight. Brent Gunning, Josh Goldberg alongside me. We'll be here with you until the Leafs and Flames are done. They've just started up the second period. Hopefully this one's a little better for the Leafs. They trail after 1-0 for Calgary. The Blue Jays, they didn't trail a whole lot last year. I think a whole lot less than most people expected. I don't know. Maybe you have, if there's one thing in life, you might occasionally put on rose-colored glasses. Because, you know, you're like me, Goldberg. Let's be honest. Be a little pessimistic at times. Like even you had to put on the rose-colored glass. Yeah, exactly. Let's not hide this at all here. We both know. We're both pessimistic, and the glass is always barely full at all. This Blue Jays team last year, obviously a lot of surprises for them, but I think it also kind of properly set expectations for this year. I mean, where are you at? What are you kind of expecting from this team this season?
I think they're going to be good. I don't see a ton of downside here. I don't think that this is a teetering type of situation where everything needs to go right for this team to be competitive. I honestly think everything would need to go wrong for them not to be a pretty good ball club. I honestly don't think they're that much worse than the Yankees. I understand why everyone's putting the Yankees tops because they have so much star power, but that rotation beyond Gerrit Cole is, you know, a lot of question marks, a lot of guys with checkered injury histories. So I don't know how much you can rely on that. Yeah, the Jays rotation has tons of question marks also. There's no getting around that. There is a world in which things break right for that Jays rotation, but I don't know how much they necessarily need it to. If the offense does as expected and the bullpen does as expected, and I think both of those things, it would be a big time surprise if the lineup isn't really good and the bullpen's really good. I think as long as the rotation is hovering around league average, you're probably going to win 90 games this year, assuming good health. I guess you could say, oh, well, what's going to happen with Teoscar? Can Bichette put it together for a full 162? Is Rowdy Tellez any good? There are a lot of things there that I think, you know, are fair to have a referendum, fair to have a conversation about. But I don't really see a ton to be pessimistic about when it comes to this ball club. I think their baseline is probably in that 85 win range, and I don't think that they'll be much lower than that realistically, and I think that they could be a 90 plus win team. I don't think that much needs to happen. I don't think that many things need to happen out of character for them to be really good this year. I think it's going to be a really good season, and I think there's the potential for it to be great if they're competitive and this front office decides to make a move or a couple of moves in season closer to the deadline in terms of trades.
Well, so that's the thing I've been kind of pointing to. You know, obviously Taiwan Walker didn't end up back here. People have been, you know, kind of opining for Odorizzi. That's the point I've been making, though, is just because they missed out on, you know, kind of those two guys, I guess you could throw Paxton into that mix as well. Just because they didn't land those guys, this isn't the rotation that's set. If this team is as good as you say it's going to be, and I think a lot of people are there, I'm right there with you in terms of how good it's going to be. There are moves to be made. There are always pitchers available. Maybe they're not the exact guy you would want to kind of put in that role, but I don't think it is some, you know, submarining thing to this team's playoff chances that they weren't able to go out and get some guy who, you know, is going to realistically be a number three starter or something like that for this team. And I know they have a hole at number two, but I don't think either of those guys would have been what you want in a number two starter.
Yeah, I don't either. Like, I think outside of Bauer, there weren't really that many guys who, at Paxton, we've talked about, I think, has the stuff to be that guy, but, you know, injuries, etc. It's far from a sure thing that James Paxton is going to do much this year, and I think his market dictated that, going back to Seattle on a deal that could pay him less than $10 million, or certainly no more than $10 million. You know, Jake Odorizzi, I would have been totally on board with that. Multi-year deal, I'm not sure about it, and what is he on a contending ball club? Is he anything more than a number three or maybe even a number four? Yeah, probably not. So once Bauer wasn't coming here, there wasn't going to be that one guy or even maybe two guys that would change the complexion that much. I still think it probably would have been the prudent move to go out and get a Paxton or an Odorizzi. I was never super high on Taiwan Walker, so I'm not necessarily that crestfallen about it, but I totally understand he was good last year, so I get not being thrilled that they didn't bring him back. But I think they're going to make a move in season, and I think that, I don't know how many of these guys will end up actually being good, but I think some combination of Ray, Stripling, Matt, Tanner Roark, you're not going to hear me saying Tanner Roark will be good. I won't do it. Until Tanner Roark puts together 12 to 15 good starts, I won't be a believer. I thought that contract was brutal when they signed it. It's brutal now. It's going to be one of those for a while where we look back on it and say, like, did his agent sprinkle pixie dust? Like, what the hell happened there? It's one of the ones that's just never really process for me. But I do think that Matt's, Stripling, Ray, I think two of those guys could be league average or better. And if you get that coupled with Ryu staying healthy and Pearson being Pearson, then we're talking about three or four above average potentially starters. And I think a lot of the noise and questions and issues that you might have with the rotation could subside a little bit.
Is it fair to say then, like, obviously there are players who will have a bigger say in the Blue Jays season who you need more out of than this player, but is it fair to say that Pearson might have the biggest say in just what exactly this team is and kind of how high their ceiling is? Because if there's a world where he's the guy we've been told he is and have seen in glimpses here, it feels like that completely changes the ceiling of this team, for me anyways.
Yes, I think he is as much as anybody. You could look at the lineup and say if Marcus Semien is anywhere near the player he was a couple of years ago, then that would just be, you know, how transcendent would this lineup be? But the lineup's going to be damn good, even if Marcus Semien is closer to the player he's been for the most of his career. And even in 2018, if he's that player, that would be great too. But the rotation just has so many question marks that you can't afford a Marcus Semien not popping, or maybe Vlad doesn't put it all together. The lineup is deep enough that you can still have a well above average offense, even if every guy doesn't perform as expected. The rotation, there's not really any margin for error, injury or otherwise, but you don't really have that ace level upside. I think Robbie Ray is capable of it, but we've seen enough of him, you know, command and home run issues to really think that him being the pitcher he was 3-4 years ago is probably not happening. Pearson, though, we have no idea. The canvas is blank. I'm throwing last year out. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if he just comes out his first start of the season, whether it's the second or third game against the Yankees, and just shoves for six and, you know, looks great, and it springboards him to a really good season. I feel like my general I guess, consensus or thought with Pearson is, even if he is excellent, how many starts are you getting from him? Mm-hmm. Are you getting more than 25? If you get 25 great starts from Nate Pearson, you'll take that and worry about what it means for you come pennant chase time, playoff time. But I do wonder what kind of season we're getting from him and what the Blue Jays are going to proceed in terms of workload. Are they going to just let him throw 95, 100 pitches every time he takes the ball? Or are they going to ease him in coming off of that flexor strain and less of a workload last year? We haven't really heard much so far in spring training. I assume it's all systems go and he'll be ready to go, and whatever his workload is, it'll be the regular allotment. But he's just, the range of outcomes for him is so extreme that, yeah, it could really do a number in terms of swaying what the ceiling ultimately is for this ball club.
Yeah, that's where I tend to land on it as well. I mean, there's a reason he was as highly and continues to be as highly touted as he is. If he can even kind of scratch that surface, then it does become, I think we'll have some fun. And boy, I have massive air quotes around fun, because it won't be fun at all. The conversations of, how do you use him? How many bullets does he have this year? Can you ramp him up? Are you ramping him up quickly enough? Is he being ramped up too quickly? It feels like we're going to have a lot of time to bat that around. You mentioned Marcus Semien there. I think he's almost kind of, you know, falling under the radar, flowing under the radar, if at all possible, just because of the Springer signing and all the hype around that. I want to hear from him as we did earlier today at spring training.
We have very similar mindsets where we work really hard. When I'm feeding him throws to second base, he said, "Hey, just throw it anywhere. I'll adjust, whatever." I was the same way when I was playing shortstop. So I'm excited to work with them, and I'm very impressed with how he looks. I can tell Bo's been working in the offseason on, everything. I haven't seen much of him, just video, because we didn't play against each other, but you can tell that he's made adjustments and he feels good with them. But once you get into the season, and first of all, spring training games and season games, you start to make some plays that build your confidence. And that's the way that I felt like I got better was, hey, wow, I can make this play in a game and impact this game with my glove, and now I'm confident, and next year I'm going to do even more. I think there's a level of confidence that's, I'm excited about, and they've brought in veteran guys to kind of show them the way and that how to navigate a full season. And a lot of these guys may have, more talent than the vets, but I think when you get the, experience and mesh it together with the talent, it's going to be something special. I think that we just need to take it day by day and not get ahead of ourselves. And we're going to get better as time goes on, but I like where we're starting right now.
There's Marcus Semien talking about the hopefully budding relationship between him and Bo Bichette. I know, when Lindor was kind of being bandied about, there was some possibility of, oh, maybe Bichette will move off of shortstop. Obviously, that's not happening, but I think we all love having the ability to have a guy in the lineup. You don't have to move things around, but now you can kind of give Bichette a day, and you're not really losing too much kind of defensively at that position.
Yeah, I think we've seen Marcus Semien be a plus defensive player for most of his career. And I don't worry about him at second base. I've seen some clips of him in the shift on that side of the bag, looking perfectly solid, turning double plays, being in the right spot. He's a good athlete. He's got a good eye out there, a good read off the bat. I think that's going to be a strong double play combination of Semien to Bichette. And I can understand, well, why did you spend $18 million on Marcus Semien? You should have spent it on pitching. We talked about this. That $18 million, who was it going to? Taiwan Walker, yep. James Paxton, Jake Odorizzi. I'd rather Marcus Semien's impact. I think Marcus Semien has the potential to be really, really good for this team and to make a huge, huge impact. And everyone's slotting him into the bottom third of the lineup, and I get it. Coming off of the year that he had, and there's more established, I guess, in the sense of established Jays. But I think that it wouldn't be at all a bold prediction or a strong take to say it won't take long for Marcus Semien to be batting higher in the order. He gets on base at a reasonably good clip. He hits for power. He can run. I like a lot of what he brings to the table. And again, this just goes back to what we're talking about how deep this lineup is. I was thinking about this yesterday. What's the ideal order? Who do you want in certain spots? I don't know if there really is a bad configuration lineup-wise for this ball club. It doesn't really matter. If Marcus Semien bats eighth, that shows that you've just got so many other options. But I wouldn't be surprised if Marcus Semien at some point or another sees four or five different spots in the lineup. Like I could see him leading off, batting second, third, seventh, eighth, ninth, sixth. I think that's going to be the hallmark calling card of this lineup, of this roster, is guys can play different positions defensively, and your lineup can look a lot different in terms of the way it's configured on a night-to-night basis.
That's always been the dream that this front office has wanted to build, right? Positionless baseball, where you can not only play a kind of any spot on the diamond, but hopefully your bat can kind of play at many, many different spots in the lineup. You know, we heard from the first half of what will be the Blue Jays double play configuration this year, Marcus Semien. Now let's hear from the other half, Bo Bichette.
Wondering, when you say that, you know, last year didn't finish the way you were hoping it would, can you be just a little bit more specific as far as, you know, was it your mental approach? Was it, you know, defense? I know you're kind of saying everything, but any specific insights you can give us as far as what it was that you would have liked to do or finish better?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was kind of everything. I mean, it definitely, I think it stemmed from maybe a mental energy I had. I don't know what it was, but, you know, I mean, last year took a toll on everybody. And I think that I didn't handle it as best as some of the guys around the league did. And so for me, it's about learning from that and not making the same mistake.
Right. And then kind of bigger picture, just a few minutes ago in Padres camp, they announced a 14-year extension for Fernando Tatis Jr., obviously incredible player, same age as you, also a son of a big leaguer. You know, without getting into specifics, what's your kind of general philosophy when it comes to, would you consider extensions? Would you want to do that kind of thing? Or how do you approach that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm happy for Fernando. I've always admired the way he plays from minor leagues till now. I mean, he's an exciting player. You know, I think it's really powerful that an organization believed in him enough to put the commitment they did. Obviously, he's probably still not going to get paid what he should have. But I think that, you know, it's good for Fernando, and I think it's good for the Padres. So that means good for baseball. And on my end of things, you know, I'm open, but obviously there's more important things at hand with camp starting today. And, you know, that's where my focus is.
Just further to that, were there any talks at all this offseason about any kind of extension with you?
It was brought up, but no offer. So I think, you know, I would rather focus on spring training the season ahead, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
I was just on that Tatis call, and already the Padres were saying stuff like, hopefully one day we'll have a statue of Tatis next to Tony Gwynn. You know, and Tatis was saying, look, it's all about winning. It's all about winning. For you, as you come into this, how much are you now putting on yourself as a dude who's been through the big league experience now for a season and a half, or parts of two seasons, whatever you want to call it, last year? About you being the guy, so to speak, one of the main guys who's going to kind of shoulder this load when it comes to winning.
Yeah, I mean, nothing changes for me. I think whether you're one of the guys or whether you're not one of the guys, you come in, you prepare, you play hard, be a good teammate, and I don't think anything really should be different from anybody's side. So I just, you know, I'll come in here and I'll continue to be prepared, continue to play hard, and continue to be available to my teammates when they need me. But you know, it's just about business and playing ball right now.
I would like to congratulate Bo Bichette on the self-restraint he showed there, because if somebody told me about the Fernando Tatis Jr. contract, I would have screamed back, yeah, if you want to give me $340 million, let's talk. Like, the fact that he can just push that aside, saying, it's not really something that's front of mind for me right now. I know it's out there for these guys, so they obviously don't think about that money quite the same way you and I do, but it blows my mind when I saw that number, and I'd imagine a guy like Bichette has to be, you know, despite what we heard from them there, thinking similarly along those lines.
Well, it's going to be fascinating. Like, Bo Bichette, I feel like he's played 75 games in the big leagues. It's not, albeit Fernando Tatis Jr. hasn't played that many more, but he's, you know, he played a closer to a full season. I know he got hurt in 2019, and then he was outrageously good this past year again in a smaller sample size. He's got more than, I think he's got double or more than the amount of games than Bo does. So 75 games, I'm not handed you 300 million after 75 games. And I wonder, you know, what are the Blue Jays, is Bo Bichette, do they view him as a shortstop long-term? And if they don't, then they're not going to pay him that kind of deal. He'll still get a bunch of money and a big offer, but the 10, 12, 14-year deal for, you know, 250 plus, 300 plus, you're not paying that to a second baseman. And I don't know if I think it's still too early to call on Bichette. There are some issues there defensively. You know, he's a good athlete, so I think that might cover some of the deficiencies. But the arm isn't particularly encouraging, and, you know, some of his reads, he was careless on a bunch of balls last year that needs to get better. And I'm still of the mind that I would be very much open to whether it's trading for Trevor Story this season, signing him next offseason, going after Correa or Seager or somebody of that ilk. I still think that that's something that the Blue Jays should look to do. That, to me, isn't an indictment or a criticism of Bo Bichette. Bo Bichette, I think, could be a very good major league shortstop. I think he could be, and maybe even more likely to be, an excellent, you know, perennial all-star second baseman. And I'm okay with that. I don't think that decreases his value by any means, but I think that this is going to be a make or break season for him at shortstop in terms of what they want to do long term. And if he has a great year, then maybe it quiets all the doubts and you pay him a huge contract and you don't pursue one of those guys. But if it's like it was this past year, he's still a little bit sloppy defensively, then I think we're going to have a real sharp and pointed conversation about what his future is at that position.
And how do you think that's going to go? Because I remember when all the Lindor stuff came out, Bichette, if I'm recalling correctly, it seemed to me like, reading between the lines, he's like, I mean, I'll move off short for that guy, but I'm not doing it for just anybody. And I'm not saying the guys you mentioned are just anybody, but it does feel like he thinks of himself really, really highly, and he thinks of himself as a shortstop. And I just worry, you know, what, if anything, that does to the kind of relationship between the team and player. I don't think we're there yet to where it's something we need to worry about, but that's where my mind goes when you start to talk about that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, totally. That's I think we're sort of seeing, I don't think that the seedlings of that, I don't think that it's the same situation with Vladdy, but Vladdy's Instagram says Blue Jays third baseman.
Love it.
He sees himself as the third baseman. He might be the only person on outside of the Guerrero family. It's like the Guerrero family is the only ones who see him as a third baseman. Pretty much all of us have acknowledged the fact that that's probably not his home. But until he can make that acceptance internally, then yeah, I think that's a sore spot as well. And what does that do for the relationship going forward? I don't know if it's anything to be too concerned about. But yeah, it's something, when player and team differ on not just contract, but position, or you just have a philosophical difference, then certainly you're going to think about what, if anything, that might mean in terms of bleeding into a contract situation. I think at the end of the day, if they can figure out some number that can kind of hedge between whether he's playing second or short in the case of Bichette, and it's term and dollars, then I think that that will probably get it done. But he could also say, you know, some other team will want to eventually play me at shortstop. I'm content to not lock into a long-term deal, get to unrestricted free agency, or free agency in the case of Major League Baseball, and take my chances and see whether it's you guys here in Toronto or some other team will pay me when I'm, you know, in my prime, pay me the salary that is commensurate with my skills at shortstop. And if you guys don't want to do it, then, you know, I'll go somewhere else.
Well said. I think we're a ways away from that conversation just yet. And you know what? We focus on way too much negative there. Go look at the pictures the Blue Jays sent out of George Springer. If you need a little breath of sunshine, which you might if you've been keeping an eye on this Leaf game, go look at that. He's smiling. I'm sure you will be too. Max Homa, he was smiling a ton yesterday. So was I, because I love golf and I was rotting on my couch watching it all. That's a lie. I was working on the update desk, keeping you informed. An amazing weekend on the PGA Tour, despite the big guys really not being involved all that much. Max Homa winning in a playoff. What a story it was. Rex Hager, the Golf Channel, will break it all down for us next here on Sportsnet Tonight. Brent Gunning, Josh Goldberg, Sportsnet Tonight here. We'll be with you for, I don't know, about another hour or so until the Leafs and Flames are done down at Scotiabank Arena. Also going to talk a little Sidney Crosby later on, one of his foreigner teammates. Tyler Kennedy going to join us after 9 o'clock. But joining us right now to break down, I mean, it was a great weekend all in all, despite not playing a lot of golf on Saturday. But really, what a finish yesterday at the Genesis Invitational. Max Homa walking away with it in effectively the home tournament for him in a playoff over Tony Finau. Rex Hager to the Golf Channel joins us now to break it all down. Rex, how you doing today?
I'm good. Yeah, I had everything you want.
Honestly, I mean, let's just start with the kind of crazy recovery shot by Homa in the playoff. I mean, I don't want to go too lofty here because I'll be honest, when I think of a crazy recovery shot late in a big tournament, I'm going to like Bubba Watson at the Masters hooking it out of the bushes. And it wasn't quite that, but man, that was a special, special shot for Homa to kind of conjure up in that moment.
Oh, he looked absolutely dead. And, you know, we sit and we talk about the 10th hole at Riviera all week long, and it's one of the special holes in golf, and it just sort of brings out the best in everyone. And what he did was exactly what you needed to do. You needed to miss the green left, and you take your chances, and sometimes you're going to end up with a lie like he ended up with. And I thought it was fascinating. I talked to his caddy after the round, who said when he first saw it, he thought, wow, we're not going to be able to get this on the green. We're just going to try to scramble for a par and hope for the best. And he said Max was relaxed. He was like, I got this. Don't worry about it. And it was really kind of a toe hook wedge where he kind of ran it up the hill. Just an unbelievable shot.
Yeah, I got to say, I was really impressed by his ability to bounce back the way that he did. Missing a, you know, a 3-foot putt on 18 for the win. And, you know, Tony Finau had his chances in the playoff and missed a couple of putts, certainly the one on 10 and then the one to keep it alive. But, you know, what does it say about Homa that he was able to dust himself off and, you know, have that resiliency to win at a course, you know, he grew up worshiping, he was in the crowd many, many times, and was able to get his, you know, second tour win?
It's hard to overestimate how good that was, right? I mean, when you miss a 3-footer, and I tweeted this, like, as soon as it happened, that this season on the PGA Tour, Max has converted 99.57% of the 3-footers he has faced. However, when you're put in this situation, I think the line I used in my column is that not all 3-footers are created equal. And certainly this one, as you just pointed out, it's a hometown event. It means the world to him. I mean, he said it himself afterwards that I don't know what I'm going to do in golf that's going to be better than this going forward. So you can certainly understand where those emotions, where those nerves came from, whatever you want to call it. What fascinates me is the idea that he got on the phone with his wife before he started the playoff, after he has missed this putt to win the most important event of his life. And he says to her, the first sentence is, I think I choked. And it's, we don't think about athletes in that context. We think about them, at least in the modern era, that they're going to be mentally strong and they're not going, they're going to put it out of their head and they're going to try to forge forward. And his wife's response was, let's work on forgiveness. Like, forget about what happened. Forgive yourself for making that mistake and move forward. It's such a different way to look at athletics, to look at pressure, to look at these situations. I just love the whole moment.
You mentioned him being on his phone there. I'm watching on TV there, and he's on the range, and he's pulling his phone out of his pocket. And I'm like, I don't know what this means, but I feel like this means he's as relaxed as he could possibly be, or he has already kind of checked out. Clearly, we know which one it was. You know, the amazing thing that worked out just kind of by happenstance is we got the playoff hole on 10 at Riv. You know, for those of you who don't know it, a drivable par 4, very, very gettable, but also penal at times. we wouldn't have got that, is my understanding, if there would have been the fans in attendance. We know how beautiful that finishing hole is, 18, the clubhouse on the hill, the amphitheater setting. I feel like the cat's kind of out of the bag now, and if we have a playoff at this thing, even with fans, I feel like they got to find a way to do it on 10 now.
I think so, because it's such an iconic hole, and you say drivable, and I only correct that because
sorta.
I've been corrected in the past. Yes, exactly, by many, many players when I say that, and they're like, well, it's not really drivable. So you can, it's driver adjacent. You can get it somewhere close, up around the front. I mean, that's your best case scenario. You're never going to hit it in one, because you talk about Max on his phone. One of the things he did as he's walking from the range to the 10th tee to start the playoff is he has a friend who was the best man in his wedding, who doesn't apparently know much about golf, and he was asking, is someone going to get an ace on the 10th hole? And, you know, they all kind of rolled their eyes. Well, as he's walking to the playoff, he just randomly texts his friend, hey, you'll think I'll get an ace on the 10th hole. And it kind of showed you how relaxed he was.
Yeah, I think he's great the way he interacts on Twitter. I feel like the stuff like that is good for golf, you know, guys having fun and interacting with fans. So I was definitely really happy to see it for him. I got to say, I was kind of gutted for Tony Finau. It's three straight starts with a second place finish. And I believe I saw he's finished second 10 times in his career. And he has the win at Puerto Rico, but a lot of people just, you know, say it's Puerto Rico. I don't know if that's necessarily quite on the caliber of a normal PGA Tour event. And, you know, there's the whole Puerto Rico curse. But, you know, what is it going to take here for Tony Finau to close? I know he shot 64 yesterday. We should celebrate that. But just, you know, to make one of those putts, a 10-footer to win a tournament, what do you think's going on? Is it something between the ears? How do we explain a player with so much talent just coming up a little bit short so many times?
Well, you talk about the three straight runner-ups. There was also a fourth-place finish at Torrey Pines. And Brighton had run. So, and I covered three out of those four in Saudi Arabia. So it's amazing when you sit and you think about how talented Tony is. And we talked about this quite a bit today on our podcast at Golf Channel. And it's hard to win on the PGA Tour, and I'm always going to lean towards the player's perspective, because in Tony's mind, and I've heard this from, you know, different angles now over three consecutive weeks, pretty much, of how he sort of justifies it. And when you pointed out, he shot a 64 in the final round. That was the best round of the day by two strokes. And when I talked to him after the round, it was all about, I needed to see if I could go low and make something happen. And he did. He put himself into a position. Now, we can sit and we can dissect it. It was actually a 7-footer on that first playoff hole that he could have converted. And he didn't. And it's not 99.57%, but it's something closer probably to 40%. And so you would have expected him to have a good chance there. I think the biggest mistake is on the second playoff hole. It's a par 3. You really just need to aim at the middle of the green. It seems to me he got a little over-aggressive and then came over the top on a little bit, not his best swing of the day, and puts himself in a terrible position and essentially gives this away. I'm still under the mindset that Tony Finau is going to win his second tour event, and then he's going to win a lot. I would kind of compare him to what David Duval did back in the day when he finally got that win and he went on that run, became world number one and a major champion. I believe that to be true. However, I remember having this conversation with Butch Harmon, the famous swing coach, about Ricky Fowler getting his first major. And Ricky was in contention on a Saturday night. I think it was at an Open Championship. And I'm talking to Butch, and I'm like, yeah, this has got to be his year. He's playing so well. And he turned to me and he goes, he is. He still has to do it. And it gives you an idea. It's hard to win on the PGA Tour, and nothing's a given. And I think the more and more Tony goes down this road where he's not converting these chances, the harder it gets.
Yeah, that's always going to be kind of the question, right? Are you building more scar tissue, or at a certain point does it become too much that you can't kind of fight through it? Rex, you talk about both of these guys a ton, so I'll do a little, not dealer's choice. I'm the dealer. You're the player. What would you like to talk about? Would you rather talk about Tiger or Jordan Spieth before we let you go?
I'd rather talk about Jordan Spieth, but I'll touch on Tiger. I'm fine with that. I know the way this works.
Okay, I gave you the out, but since you're nice enough to play along here, Tiger Woods, we saw him. We have all played, armchair doctor with Tiger on the course many a time. Would you like to play armchair doctor based on him sitting in a TV booth adjacent to Jim Nantz? Did you read anything into his appearance? Did it give you any leanings one way or another as to when we'll see him again and what he'll look like when we do?
it was so much more pessimistic than I would have expected.
Yeah.
Given what the little bit of information that we had, and most of it came from Nota Begay, who said on Golf Channel that he was hitting balls, you know, just a few weeks ago, and he felt like he was trending in the right direction and that this procedure was not that big of a deal. It turns out, if we can take anything from Tiger on Sunday, it was a big deal, and this is going to take longer than we thought. And when his response from when Jim Nance asked, what about the Masters, is his response is, God, I hope so, it gives you an idea where his mindset is. I just don't think – and look, I mean, I think we've all come to the conclusion that this is going to be Tiger. This is the new reality, that if he's healthy, he can still do special things like he did at the 2019 Masters, like he did at the Zozo Championship in 2019. However, those times are going to be few and far between, and we saw it Sunday, certainly when he's sitting in the booth, when he's just sitting down, and you can tell he's not entirely comfortable. We saw it last year when he was playing with his son Charlie in the father-son event in December. Yeah, I just think it's the new reality.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, and that's why when we do see good Tiger, and I still am of the belief we're going to see it from time to time, that's why I think everyone's going to get so much more kind of eager and excited, because you nailed it there. These chances for him to kind of be at his best are fewer and farther between as he gets older, as it is for all of us. Rex, thoroughly enjoyed the time tonight. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
There he goes, Rex Hoggard, Golf Channel. You should check out that column. It was a good one. Goldie, I mean, I know you're glued to golf like I am most weekends, but it felt like this weekend kind of exceeded expectations even.
Excellent. Riviera is the best, man. It's my favorite course. I read, you know, John Wood, the former caddy, mm-hmm. who's now an analyst, said that all course architects should look at what they do with Riviera. You know, not that impressive a piece of property, and you know, there's not a lot of OB, and there's, I don't think, any water. If there is, there's very little. I don't think there's any, and it's consistently one of the best courses year in and year out. The setup is mostly the same. They do a great job with it. It's just, it's such a classic course. There's so many risk-reward holes. There's a lot of challenging holes coming in on the back nine. It was just, you know, it was, as always, an entertaining tournament, and, you know, great finish. And Homa played great. The ball striking was great, as it always is with him. Putting has always, I feel like, been the bugaboo, the thing that can hold him back, and it was good to see him bounce back after missing that three-footer. But, you know, the Finau thing, I am inclined to lean with Rex that the Duval comparison is a good one, and he'll rip off some wins here. But the more this happens, the more you have to believe that this just could be one of those star-crossed, unfortunate situations where he just racks up top tens, top fives, third, seconds, and just is unable to really close the deal.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it all be crazy? And we got a jet so we could talk to Nick, but who are you pulling for there, Homa or Finau? Because I was pulling for Homa the whole way. I don't wish any ill will on Tony Finau, but I think having him in the sport is an incredible thing. To have this guy who is right there, peak of his powers, but can never totally get it done. I love having that, and it's nothing against him personally. Believe me, there are guys I watch on TV and root against them because of how I feel about them. That's not the case for Finau, but I was pulling for Homa hard.
I think I was too, you know, considering I knew how much it meant to him. But it was a tough one because I've always been a Finau fan. He just seems like such a nice guy, right? And it's really rough to hear these questions about what kind of positives can you take away from coming up short. And the post-round interview was rough. Like, he's heard it enough. He knows that he just needs to close to shut these kinds of questions up. So that kind of hurt a little bit. But yeah, it was good to see Homa. And the emotional reaction, hey, sports needs more of that. Guys,
for sure.
You know, showing their emotions and how much it meant to him. I thought it was a great moment. It wasn't a major, but it clearly meant a lot to him. And I feel like he has the game to really be a factor. He's not going to be on the JT DJ level because guys like that are, you know, they're different. They're special.
Yeah.
But he can win a bunch of times. Like, he has the game, and he clearly has the chops and has the moxie to hold up down the back nine of a legit course like Riviera. I think we're going to see a lot from Max Homa going forward.
Yeah. That's his second win on tour. The other one came at Quail Hollow. So, yeah, big boy tracks for him. Anytime you can win at two major venues, not too shabby at all. Max Homa, great win for him. It's not been great for the Toronto Maple Leafs tonight. Maybe they turn that thing around in the third period. Nick Albergo will tell us what's gone on so far when Sportsnet tonight. Not the night the Leafs would have liked down at Scotiabank Arena, trying to stay hot, keep that little win streak going. So far, not so good against Calgary, trailing after two periods. Someone who has his pulse on all things NHL, but especially on Leafs game nights, the Toronto Maple Leafs. Nick Alberga, you'll hear him once the game is done right here on these very airwaves, joins us right now. Nick, how's it going, bud?
Not too bad. How are you guys tonight?
Doing good, doing good. You know, I thought about going full Zegras for you down in Anaheim and giving you the hot lap, just going silent to start the block here, but I thought that wouldn't be nice. Always happy to have you on. So what's your kind of big takeaway from the first two periods? Obviously, Josh and I have had half an eye on it here, but what have you made of the Leafs' effort tonight?
You know what? It hasn't been that bad at all. Like, I've actually been rather impressed with the way the Maple Leafs are playing, considering, you know, the quick changes. Hutchinson comes in, Hyman, Thornton, the list goes on and on of guys out of this lineup, and they've actually played rather well. Like, I think they just haven't got the puck luck that they've gotten earlier on this season tonight. David Riddick has been solid, making 26 saves through 40 minutes here. It's not like Toronto didn't have ample opportunity either on the power play. They're 0-for-5, including 1:36 of a two-man advantage in the second period. They look rather slow and complacent on that, and that's been sort of a thing from time to time with this team when it comes to 5-on-3s. But all in all, they've had plenty of opportunities. Again, I think Calgary has been pretty decent in this game. I think Toronto's controlled the puck, but sometimes you just don't have the puck luck, and so far through 40, they just haven't had it.
Yeah, I guess if this game ends in a loss, but, you know, it continues on this trajectory where they get a lot of chances. If the reason you end up losing this game is that David Riddick just had, you know, almost an out-of-body experience considering the way he's played for a while, that's something I feel like you can't get too negative about. I know you always want to get bent out of shape when it comes to the Maple Leafs, and especially, when they lose a game and it doesn't go the way that a lot of people expect. If they lose and it goes this way, I don't think you can really take anything away from it other than you just ran into a hot goaltender.
You're right. Sometimes you got to tip your cap, Josh. Again, there is still 20 minutes left in this game. And if there's a team who can come back from 2-0 right now in this league, it's probably the Maple Leafs in that quick strike offense. Of course, we're seeing John Tavares on that top line with Marner and Matthews. They look just a smidget off so far tonight. I think Willie Nylander as a whole has actually been pretty decent. I was curious to see his response coming back from being benched yet again on Saturday. So I think you're totally right. Sometimes you got to tip your cap. Riddick's been solid, but he's not been overly tested. And in terms of, you know, hard opportunities, it's more so to the outside and distant opportunities. But again, you can't fault the guy. He's locked in tonight. And I think the Maple Leafs just need to keep competing the way they have been. And they'll find it eventually here.
You mentioned Keith loading up the top line with Tavares up there. What do you think that's kind of mostly about? Because I'm of two minds. I think on one hand, it's a challenge to Nylander. Go ahead, yes. Drive this line. Prove to me you can do it. But I also think this is about kind of keeping that top line hot. If there's anybody who can do a good Joe Thornton or Zach Hyman impersonation, it's probably the captain who makes $11 million a year. Like, what do you think it's more? What do you think the lines tonight, especially those top two, is more about?
Yeah, that's exactly how I transcribed it, Gunnar. Certainly just that. They want to get John Tavares going, so put him with the two hottest players on the ice, and Mitch Marner and Austin Matthews. And there's been ample opportunity, including in the first period on the power play. Morgan Riley hit the crossbar, and John Tavares had the rebound, sort of tried to flip it, and Riddick made his best save of the night. So I think you'll give and live with those opportunities that these guys are getting. And I think for the most part, in terms of puck possession, they've been rather dominant. And then, as you mentioned with Nylander, I think driving his own line and seeing, you know, if he has the fortitude in him, considering, again, he was benched on Saturday. And for me, at least, I think he's passed the test. I saw him back check a couple times, which is always, you know, something unusual to see in Willie Nylander's world. So all in all, again, you know, we look at this roster sometimes and say, hey, they should have it every night. But I mean, even the best players in this world, even the best teams in this planet don't have it every night. And that's pretty much what's happening so far tonight for the Maple Leafs.
What have you made of Mikko Lehtonen's game tonight? Because I think he's steadily gotten more comfortable the more he's played. But I've been pretty impressed. He's been pretty poised. He's generated some chances. He has 3 shots on net, only 8.5 minutes. But I feel like this is maybe the best version of Mikko Lehtonen we've seen so far in the NHL.
Yeah, I think he's been fine. I think certainly as we've seen with Sheldon Keefe early on, like he's not going to have any favorites. I think we're seeing it a bit here with Alex Galchenyuk can't find his way into the lineup. I think he's really going to see what he has here. And I think you're right. As the games go on, I think Lettinen is proving more and more, not only to the fan base, but to the coaching staff, that he can stick as a National Hockey Leaguer. You know, the one guy I was watching for tonight was Travis Dermott, who was elevated in a top four role. I think he's been pretty decent. I think defensively speaking, the Maple Leafs have actually been pretty good in this game. You know, the one goal, certainly the Tkachuk tip, you're not really going to stop that. And then the first one, I'm sorry to say, you got to pin it on the goalie. And the way this night started for Michael Hutchinson, I said, here we go again. But, you know, to his credit, I think he's hung in there, with exception, again, to the first goal. It should probably be a 1-0 game. But still, you'll get this type of goaltending from your backup every day of the week for sure.
Well, I asked Gord this, and, you know, I'm curious if it changed at all kind of in the or continued in the second period, because this team just looked different with Hutch behind them last year. They seemed tentative. They seemed apprehensive. They weren't themselves. Have you noticed that at all tonight, or do you feel like they've kind of been able to? Again, I don't like putting this all on him because he's bad. Like, there's no doubt about it, but you can't blame the way 20 other guys are playing on a goaltender who lets in some soft goals. So, you know, how have you made of how the team's reacted to having him back there, and especially with the kind of weak early goal?
You know what? Watching this game brought shades of the bubble for me against Columbus. Remember when they couldn't solve either of those guys, and Merzlikins and Korpisalo, and they were throwing everything but the kitchen sink at them? For some reason, I can't get that memory out of my head watching this game tonight, because I do think Toronto's been the better team. And again, the officials maybe have helped them out a tad. They're 0-for-5 on the power play. I think actually the PK has been pretty strong as well. In the second period specifically, Ilya Mikheyev had 2 breakaways and couldn't score. Jason Spetz had a shorthanded chance. So I think we're starting to see the PK do some better work in the last 5, 6, 7 games. Always positive news. So, you know, I think all in all, when you look at tonight's game, I think there's a lot of positives to pull through 40. Again, if there's a team who can come back, it's probably the Toronto Maple Leafs. But I don't think it should be down on what Hutchinson has brought or what they've brought as a team tonight. Because, again, there's been a lot that's happened throughout this day, and they've really stepped up, in my opinion, so far.
And Nick, before we let you go, Crosby played his 1,000th game over the weekend. I don't even know what to say, but I like to offer everyone a chance to kind of opine on, you know, the greatest player of his generation. Now, you know, what'd you make of everything we heard this weekend about Sid the Kid?
You know, it's just one of those guys that I'll forever resonate with, and it's more so because we share the same birthday. Like, I always, you know, him and Mike Trout, for some reason, born on August 7th, Crosby's 87. But again, there's no doubting what he has meant to this sport and this game, and how incredible he's been and the resume he's built. I know the debate's been roaring on the last week or so where he ranks all time. Like, he's got to be up there for me, guys, what he's meant to that market. Like, I think we forget Crosby doesn't go to Pittsburgh. I don't know if the Penguins are still in Pittsburgh, right? Like, I just think of the body of work of what he did for that organization and how much of a pro he is. Like, I was chuckling the other day. Nobody knows Sidney Crosby as a long-term girlfriend. Heck, they could even, you know, be married at this point, and nobody knows anything about the guy, which I, you know, completely respect in this day and age of social media. Just the professionalism that he brings, not only on the ice, but off of it, is uncanny, guys.
I'll be honest. There was the video going around of his parents kind of wishing him congrats. Yeah. And I'm like, I mean, I guess he has parents. It never occurred to
exactly.
me. I just figured he was created in some lab out east there. Nick, thanks so much for jumping on, and have a good show post game. Hopefully you have a good third period to talk about here.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Take care.
There he goes. Nick Alberga, Leafs pre and post game tonight with Gord Stellick. Once the final horn, Leafs trailing the Flames. Talk to him a little bit about Crosby at the end there, and who better to talk about Crosby than one of his former teammates? We will talk to Tyler Kennedy, former Pittsburgh Penguins forward. He's actually played with quite a few greats in this league, so a lot to talk about with him. We'll see if he's been keeping tabs on the Scotia North Division as well. Probably about a half hour left here on Sportsnet tonight. Sportsnet tonight, Brent Gunning, Josh Goldberg will be here with you for, I don't know, about another half hour till the Leafs and Flames are done down at Scotiabank Arena. Boy, oh boy, things keep getting worse for the Leafs. Flames now up 3-0 in the third period. That goal just crossing the goal line there. Sean Monahan finding the back of the net. But we're not worried about all that. We're worried about a guy who played the 1,000th game of his NHL career over the weekend, Sidney Crosby. And, well, who better to talk about him than somebody who played with him? Won a cup with him, in fact. Boy, that's pretty good. Had a great NHL career in his own right as well. Tyler Kennedy joins us right now tonight. Tyler, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Man, we are fired up to talk to you. You know, anytime you can, anytime you're lucky enough, I can imagine to play with a teammate as great as Sid. And I feel like you played. I was just looking at your hockey DB. Boy, you played with a lot of studs. You know, what is it about him? What is it you can kind of tell us about him as a teammate? Because from the outside, you know, I'd have a problem believing he'd say more than six words just because he seems so locked in and focused on everything. What was it like playing with him?
It was such a great experience. I honestly look back now and I wish I would have studied him more, you know, just because at the time I didn't realize how dialed in he was, you know, and playing with him for so long, he was always ready to play. He took care of himself so well. Like, he was the best at all that, you know. Obviously he was one of the best players to ever lace him up, but he was the most prepared coming to the rink, from his diet to his mental state to him being prepared to practice hard every day. And he knew how to judge his body, what his body needed, how much rest he needed. And again, Sid was a guy that would love to joke around. He was just like us, you know. He loved being chirped, you know, because you talk to him now, he goes, a lot of the young guys don't really say too much, you know, because he's such an icon now, you know. But back then we used to have guys like Billy Garrett, Hal Gill, guys that would just, you know, they would make fun of him just like they made fun of everyone else. And I think Sid loved that part of it when we played. And again, Sid was, I have nothing but great things. And I the only regret I have playing with him is I didn't study and follow him around a lot more than I did.
So in the last couple of days, there's been a lot of talk about Sid's, you know, some legendary stories at practice and just how intense his practice regimen was. You know, in your time with the Penguins, do you have any, you know, memorable moments from practice and what Sid was all about? You know, not a game, you know, when he was practicing, whether it was, you know, workouts, full team situation. Can you give us anything on that?
Honestly, he was, you know, he always had something with putting the puck in the net. You know, he always, even after a drill was done, he'd place a puck in the net. He always tried to finish the drill. He always did the drill right. And like, I played with him for 6 years. I don't think I've ever seen him screw up a drill. You know, he was definitely not a drill buster, and obviously with drills and stuff. But the biggest thing I remember, I was in like a 15 game, 20 game slump, and Sid was actually, that's when he was hurt or something, and I was struggling. I was, you know, you ride the roller coaster playing in the NHL, and I remember Sid coming over after practice and just talking to me, just like pretty much a coach would, but he got a lot more out of me. But he was just, you know, giving me a lot of really good tips of, you know, how to get more production from what I'm doing and where to go on the ice. And literally the next game, I remember I scored a goal and I had an assist, and I kind of got in a little bit of a run, and I swear it was from Sid's little pointers, you know, of where to go, you know, where to, you know, when you're making moves, how to go to the net, and, you know, obviously, you know, filter the puck to the net. And again, that was one of the coolest things about when he was at practice. He tried to help everyone because he was about team success. Obviously, he has a lot of his own success, but the way the guy cared about his team and his teammates, that's the best thing, the best quality I've seen in anyone, any players that Sid has above them, is the way he cared about his teammates and his team.
Talking to Tyler Kennedy, former Pittsburgh Penguin, and not former, you're this forever, cup champion with the Penguins. You know, you played in those back-to-back series with the Red Wings. I mean, I remember those. I remember both sides of it. You know, it's just such a unique scenario that I don't think we've seen since, in teams kind of going back to back. What do you remember from those years? And obviously, specifically for you, you'd like to remember the good one more so.
Yeah, obviously the first one was my first year in the NHL, so I didn't realize how hard it was to get to the finals. I was like, wow, we're into the finals. Okay.
This,
you know,
great,
when we,
yeah,
lost, I just remember like a lot of the old guys really taking it hard. Like, I mean, crying in the room and just, and I was a young guy, and I was like, oh, my God, yeah, this sucks. But, like, you know, I'm hoping I got a couple more years of crack at this, you know. And, you know, and the older guys are like, no, this is, there's guys who go their whole career without cracking it, you know. And I didn't realize. And then next year, we end up going back, and we had that coaching change from Therrien to Dan Bylsma. It was a big
change in the way we played hockey. The way we, you know, we had a lot more structure. We had a lot more plays with, you know, face-offs and this and that. And I think our team really came together. I think our leaders, you know, with Sid, Gino, with Kunitz coming, with Billy Guerin coming, taking some of the pressure off Gino and Malkin helped a lot. And then the big one for me was what I think really kind of pushed us over is when Anaheim, we crushed. I think when we played Carolina, Gino was on fire. Gino had like 7 goals in 4 games. We swept them. So we had like a week and a half off. And we were resting, and I remember Detroit, they went to Game 7 against Anaheim. And we knew that if we can hang on to the series longer and longer, it worked out to our benefit. And that's kind of what happened. We knew, you know, if we win that Game 6, we go to Game 7, who knows? And we have the young legs, and they're hurting. They just went through a hard series with Anaheim, with travel, you know, and that's the biggest thing that I saw that really helped us win. So
yeah, it's amazing. I can only imagine, you know, what kind of a factor attrition plays in the playoffs. And just hearing you talking about kind of, you know, how hard the old guys took it in that first year. I'm looking at your hockey DB here, and I mentioned it. You played with some real legends in this league. I mean, I know your longest tenure was with the Penguins, but you had some time in San Jose as well. You know, what were your memories like of playing with Joe Thornton? And you know, I am not going to ask you to kind of, you know, say who you like better or whatever, but how can you kind of compare and contrast him and Sid as guys? Because I mean, both legends in the game, but it feels like their personalities couldn't be more almost opposite from what we see outside.
Yeah, you know what, it was a big change for me going from Pittsburgh. That was very, very structured, very everyone, like when we lost a game in Pittsburgh, it was like the next day guys were down. You know, in San Jose, it was a little bit different. You know, guys, life moved on, and it's not that they weren't more focused or whatever. It was just a different mentality. And I remember Jumbo, he was one of the guys that brought everyone together. He was a guy that, you know, helped his young guys. He was an ultimate leader with the way he ran a room. And I just remember he was again, the way he kept it loose. You know, Jumbo's great with keeping it loose and making sure guys feel comfortable, but when it was time to drop the puck, the guy had a switch, and it was he'd block a shot with his face to show the guys that he was all in, you know. And Jumbo, again, he's a special guy, special player. And even Patty Marleau, those guys are old veteran guys that know how to get it done. But you know, coming from Sidney Crosby, the guy that's pretty much has hockey on his shoulders. and the way Sid carries himself, again, Sid is, you know, he's not, he treats everyone the same, from a first year guy to a last year guy. You know, he takes care of his current teammates. He takes care of his former teammates by just checking in, making sure they're all right. So again, I've been really fortunate. And no, it's crazy. When I got traded from Pittsburgh, yeah, I mean, to San Jose, and then I got traded to the Islanders, that's when I had John Tavares as the captain there, you know. And I remember John was starting to train with Sid, and I can see how John was really memorized by how Sid trains and really understood what it really took. And I think that's what made, you know, that's what really helped John Tavares become the player he is now, because I think he saw and he took the maturity to develop and do what he needed to do in the summers with nutrition and training to become, you know, an elite of elite in the NHL.
So as Sid, you know, eclipses 1,000 games, he's 33 years old. There's all this talk about, you know, what's Pittsburgh's future. Like, what do you expect from Sid the next, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years? You know, it's hard to imagine him declining at all, but like, are you still expecting contending for cups in Pittsburgh? Like, is there a scenario where you could see Sid play for another team? What do you expect for the next couple of years for Sid?
you know, whenever you have Sid and Malkin and Letang on your team, you know, when they can, I still think they can, they have the talent to turn it on to be the best of the best. You know, they know what it takes. They've been in a lot of playoffs. You know, they know what it takes to win. And I think that says a lot to them. And so I still think Sid's got a lot of time left. I think he's still, especially the way he talks now, that they're going to cut his laces off to kind of get him. You know, I think he's going to play. And, you know, I think Sid really likes Tom Brady, and you see what Tom Brady's doing, you know, and I think that, like, that kind of stuff motivates Sid to, you know, be on the top as, you know, even longer than he already is, you know. And, you know, you see McDavid talk about Crosby and calling him Mr. Hockey, you know, like, you know, you look around the league, everyone knows who the top dog is still. So, and I think he's got a lot more left. I think he's got more years. So
that's the kind of interesting thing. Like, we up here have been having a ton of debates of, oh, is Austin Matthews closing the gap on Connor McDavid? And then whenever we're having these debates, it does seem like we all kind of have a moment, whether it's I'm doing it on the show here, or I'm texting with my buddies, where we have to do the thing where we're like, well, I mean, you know, Crosby can still turn it on and be that guy anytime he needs to be for this team. Like, the kind of deference of respect that he gets is, you know, completely earned. And it's funny how you see it kind of across the league. You know, we talked a lot about the kind of great players you played with throughout your NHL career. And, you know, I can't help but notice that you're a 34-year-old guy who played for the Sioux Greyhounds. And, well, the GM in Toronto, he is a 35-year-old guy who was the GM there. Did you have any dealings in Dubas during your time in the Sioux?
No, it's crazy. So my first year in junior, Kyle Dubas was like the stick boy, and he was around helping around the rink. That's the scary thing. And to see what he's done, but I just knew he was all in hockey. He wanted to learn as much as you can, you know, and being, again, he was like, he's a year older than me, but he was helping out, you know. And again, like, all I knew is this guy loved hockey. And coming back, once I played, and then he started being the GM of the Greyhounds, and I used to come back in the summers to train and do all, like, live there in the summer in the Sioux. I just remember he ran the Greyhounds like an NHL team. The way the kids, you know, they're our kids, but the way they ate, the way they took care of themselves, this training staff were getting Sheldon, because, again, I used to go and, you know, jump on the ice with the junior players, and Sheldon used to run practice. And again, the way he treated me, the way he trained the kids, the way he trained the ex-player, or the current players, you know, I knew this guy was something special. And Kyle Dubas, he's a special GM, and young, he's got a lot of time ahead of him. And even Sheldon Keefe, I've been around a lot of coaches, and I've been around a lot of NHL coaches, and I would say he's better than a lot of the coaches that I had in the NHL.
When you say that, what exactly do you mean? As a player, what are you looking for? Like, I have so many of these conversations, and it just comes down to, well, how much did a guy play and who were his line mates? Like, that seems to be how most kind of casual fans judge it. But for a player, what are you looking for a quote unquote good coach?
I think trust. I think that's a big one for me. And being personal, you know, understanding the player, you know. And another big one for me is making sure everyone knows what their job is on the team. You know, I think I've had, you know, I think my best coach in NHL was Dan Bylsma. And I think the biggest reason I say that, it's not that I love Dan. I used to hate him a lot. Yeah. Yeah. But I respected him. And I think that's the big thing that gets confused these days, is you don't have to like your coach, but you have to respect him. And I like Dan too, but I hated him too a lot, but I respected him. But I remember he really gave me a lot of direction of what kind of player I was and what kind of player I needed to be successful. And that helped me out a lot. And I think a lot of coaches, other coaches that I had, didn't really do that for me. You know, they didn't really say, hey, this is what you need to do every night and I'll play you more, or you'll be successful. You know? So I think that helps. That's, in my opinion, makes a great NHL coach, knowing that where each guy needs what needs to be done and what each line needs to be done. And I think that's what really helped us win this Stanley Cup, because every line knew what their job was. And again, talking to Sheldon, seeing how he coached his junior team, I can tell you right now, I'm pretty sure everyone in the Toronto Maple Leafs knows what their job is and what they need to do to play.
Oh, well, really well said. Tyler, thank you so much. I honestly was excited to talk to somebody who played with Sid, and then, boy, you checked plenty more boxes than that, especially for guys who talk about the Leafs as often as we do. Tyler, thanks so much for the time. Really, really appreciate it.
No problem, guys. Thanks for having me.
There he goes. Anytime you talk to a Stanley Cup champ, good night by my books. Tyler Kennedy there. Great job by, a little bit great job by you, Goldberg. Great job by producer Mark Boffo. Obviously, you know, that we have Sid on the brain because he played his 1,000th game this weekend. So that kind of led to the conversation of, you know, where is he in the top five? And it's just such a tough conversation to have once you get mixing eras. And are defensemen even hockey players? Like, outside of Bobby Orr, would anyone other than David Amber ever put a defenseman in the top five? It's just it's a fun conversation to have because it can go just about any way, but it feels like it's just about impossible to come to a consensus on.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I've been wrestling with it as I prepped and we were going to talk about it. I think I'm putting him in there. I guess, you know, like, what's the Mount Rushmore of NHL players? I guess you're putting Gretzky, you're putting Howe, Bobby Orr. I Mario's in my top five. He's got to be. I understand injuries played a factor, but how much? Worse isn't the right word. If Mario Lemieux was a little bit healthier, we'd look at him in the same vein as Wayne Gretzky. Like, it was incredible just how dominant he was when he was on the ice in terms of just a point per game basis. But Sid is, I think, in terms of players who have played 1,000 games, he's got the third highest point per game rate, behind Gretzky and Marcel Dion, who's also just an underrated all-time legend of the game. I'm putting Sid up there, though, because of just the impact he's had on that franchise and the Cups and the Olympic. The golden goal has to count for something. Gold as well. He's done it at every single level. There's not one hole in his resume outside of he missed, you know, a bunch of time over, what was it, maybe a three-year span after the former Leaf. Who am I thinking of that hit him
Steckel
at the Winter Classic? David Steckel. That's it. It was on the tip of my tongue. Other than that, it's just been, it's been so good. And as I was watching that ceremony of the other night, it was really cool to see Sid kind of getting emotional. It dawned on me how wild it is that we're seeing Sid play his 1,000th game, LeBron crossing 35,000 points, and we've seen every game of their career. We've been, you know, adult enough sports fans, you and I, that we've really, like, we've grown up with those two guys. And it's just kind of bittersweet that they're getting to the point now where they're way closer to the end than they are to the beginning.
No, nobody makes me feel older than Crosby and LeBron, because they're like the last two. They're the two greats that are just older than me, so that I was still kind of, you know, fanboy a youth when I was going through it all. Those are the two guys that seeing them kind of reach these milestones, it just makes me feel ancient. And, you know, the Crosby thing, he's incredible. I don't know how you make a top five list that doesn't include him, because I just think of you look at what he kind of means to the era. I think he is a player where you can honestly put the stat sheet away when you kind of look at your top five, or you're putting together your Mount Rushmore or whatever you want to call it. The way I do this for me is I look at it as, do you have a seat at the table? Let's say it's Last Supper style. You've got Gretzky in the middle, and then it's, do you have a seat there? And I think there's enough people that Sidney is one of those guys who will always forever have a seat at the table. When they're doing these lists in 30 years, in 50 years, he's going to have a seat at the table there. And I think that, you know, there's just the difference between a guy like him and Ovechkin. Ovechkin's the better goal scorer for sure. But it's just when you kind of compare and contrast the two guys who have dominated this, you know, really two decades of NHL player, or close to it now, it's always going to come down to a conversation about those guys, and everyone's always going to put Crosby above it because of everything he accomplished. It's just when you factor in all of those things, I almost feel like you have to give a heavyweight belt for every era, if you will. And, you know, maybe Mario gets shorted there because he was in the same one as Wayne, but that's kind of the way I do it. It's just like, were you the guy in your era? And if you are, you deserve a seat at the table. And I think it's painfully obvious that Crosby is.
Yeah, he was the guy. There's no doubt. You're right about Ovechkin, and Ovechkin getting a cup was certainly huge for his overall body of work. I don't think we'd disparage him if he didn't end up winning a Stanley Cup, but it's a huge boost for him. But, you know, the way we're talking about Sid at the Olympics, and that boosts the overall body of work, you know, Ovechkin hasn't had that level of success at the Olympics. Russia has always, you know, kind of come up lame, and I think you have to factor that in a little bit. And Sid has gotten the better of Ovi a bunch of times in the playoffs. I know on the way to the Cup back in 2018, Washington finally slayed the Dragon, but Pittsburgh before that was 3-0 in the playoffs against Washington since Crosby and Ovechkin came into the league. And that counts for something. You've handled your chief rival three times in the playoffs. And, you know, and as much as anything, I give Sid so much credit for, he had kind of a renaissance. You know, back in 2014, he was 27, 28, and everyone was talking, well, the Pens haven't won a cup. They haven't been back to the final in 5 or 6 years. They're kind of stuck in this weird spot. They're not quite good enough. Sid still puts up numbers, but is he as impactful as he was maybe earlier in his career? And then he just went on an all-time heater of a couple years. He scores 50 goals for the first time, wins the World Cup, wins back-to-back cups, back-to-back Conn Smythe, and any doubt about his legacy was, you know, that was it forever. It was a real drop your rings on the table type of situation. And doubts are coming out. He just says, you know what, to hell with this, and shuts everyone up with as good of a stretch of hockey as we've probably seen in our, you know, lifetime watching sports. I haven't seen anything quite like that at every level. And, you know, as great as McDavid is, and as great as, you know, MacKinnon and Matthews are, they have got so, so far to go to be even mentioned in the same breath as Sidney Crosby. And it speaks to his excellence, his body of work, his resume, that players like that have such a tall task to even get in his level.
I'm so happy you brought up the McDavid thing there, because the bar is just set so unbelievably high, and that's good. That's how it should be. Connor McDavid, a player like him, and not that he would be saying this, but it shouldn't be get your cup and then you're done here. No, it should be have a kind of mini dynasty. That's like where the floor is for what's expected of him. And, you know, you mentioned Crosby, and I'm a firm believer in the best guys. There's just something magic about them, something special. They always seem to have these moments, you know, to bring it to golf. I think about Tiger and the chip at 16. Think about how many times chips have been hit on that hole at the Masters, but it was the best guy, the magic guy, who got that special role and that special moment. And I just think for Crosby, how many of those moments has he had? Yeah, you mentioned the big one of the golden goal in 2010. Of course, that's going to be remembered forever. Of course, that should count. But I think to so many other ones, the dueling hat trick with Ovechkin, the shootout goal in the outdoor game, going backhand shelf against the Canadians his rookie year. There's just, and I guess, yes, is it kind of, you know, my own bias being built in that I remember these things? Yeah, some of it is that, but it's just, it feels like if there was any kind of where to quibble, that's the kind of stuff that helps push him over the edge for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's just, I don't know what it is about him. There's just, I get a different vibe. I always have watching him play hockey, you know, just the way he's so cerebral. Like with McDavid, he's just the speed just gives him such an unfair advantage over everyone else on the ice. He's just so singularly faster than any other player on the ice at any time that it just enables him to do things that very few players who have ever laced him up on an NHL rink can do. Sid has tons of great tools, but as much as anything, it was always his mind, right? His brain separated him amongst anything else. great skater, really strong on the puck, hard to knock off, had the huge ass like Jágr did that just made him, you know, such a load to really take down. But it was always just, you know, the hand-eye, batting pucks out of midair, and just his ability to always be in the right spot at the right time. I don't think I can name a more positionally sound forward or maybe player in the last 10 plus years than Sidney Crosby. As much as his skill set separated him from everything else, it was what went on between the ears, and I think just gave him an advantage over every single player who was on the ice at any point during his career.
Yeah, for that aspect, in terms of a guy who could just kind of be cerebral about it, I almost have to go back to, like, Lindstrom, and you don't really think of them as comparable guys, but that's where my mind goes on that. We could talk about Crosby all day, and we kind of sort of have here on Sportsnet tonight. Got a little bit of a segment left here. Going to talk about this weird story coming out of Seattle with the Mariners. Leafs and Flames almost done, unfortunately, but very fortunately for you. Leaf Station postgame will be coming up shortly, but we've got one segment left here on Sportsnet tonight. Not too much rambling tonight. Brent Gunning, Josh Goldberg, fun show. Really, really enjoyed our chat with Tyler Kennedy talking about all things Sidney Crosby, Joe Thornton, Kyle Dubas. Man, that conversation went a lot of places. Thanks to everybody who helped us put the show together. But most importantly, thank you for listening. Leafs Nation postgame is next.